On this week's program, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns profiles the late Italian-American composer Giancarlo Menotti. Susan Lewis considers the 20th century Pennsylvania sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Escherich. And we speak with Donald Malley, Artistic Director of The Crossing, the internationally renowned Philadelphia-based chamber choir. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Giancarlo Menotti was one composer who didn't have to wait until old age or death to be appreciated. Quite the opposite, in fact. He started at the top. He went straight from the Curtis Institute to the Metropolitan Opera in La Scala and stayed there long enough to redefine what being at the top meant for an opera composer. Some of his best operas were premiered on network TV and Broadway, two of them winning Pulitzer Prizes. But the last 40 years of his life, up to his death at age 95 in 2007, were as compositionally poor as his early years had been rich. Was he out of fashion? In creative decline? Now, in Menotti's 100th birthday year, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns seeks perspective on this glamorous yet elusive figure.
Is it possible that Giancarlo Menotti reached a point where he couldn't invent opera characters as interesting as himself? His gallery of personalities included a woman too addicted to her telephone to let her boyfriend propose marriage, a mystic afflicted with stigmata, a cheerfully crippled boy who was miraculously cured, and a psychic medium whose fake seances are aided by a gypsy boy without a tongue. As Menotti became famous with works such as The Consul, A Mall in the Night Visitors, and The Saint of Bleecker Street, he was partying with movie stars, living with the equally famous composer Samuel Barber as a domestic partner, and later bought a Scottish estate while running around the world staging his operas, as well as various Spoleto festivals in Italy and Charleston. Periodically, he returned to Philadelphia in various incarnations. Some of his operas were premiered here. Some of his best stage directing efforts, including Tchaikovsky's Queen of Spades, were televised from the Academy of Music. But now that Menotti isn't here to stage his works to their best effect and galvanize attention with his magnetic personality, how do these early works hold up? Though a hit on Broadway in the 1950s, The Consul played to some empty seats at Opera New Jersey's Season this summer, but with a hearty audience response. Menotti's story of Kafkaesque bureaucracy is something that the company's chief executive, Richard Russell, had wanted to stage for years.
First of all, it's a great piece of drama. I think it's a timely subject. And I think that the way that he incorporates the music into the text makes it very present. It doesn't. One of the things that strikes me occasionally about operas in English, although not the great ones, but sometimes the English text sounds kind of precious. But in this work, I really feel like Menotti's found a way to really express the English text, the American text, really, and which is stunning in the fact that he'd only been speaking English for probably 15 years at that point.
I found Menotti to be very accessible, but at the same time, not overly simple.
Mark Oberthorn, the Philadelphia-based sound restorationist, was only familiar with Menotti's children's opera, A Mall and the Night Visitors, when he began working on a new series of original cast Menotti reissues that are coming out with considerable acclaim on the Naxos recording label.
One moonstone to make you sleep, one red coral to hear your woe.
His reaction to Menotti was much the same as audiences some 60 years before.
There's a directness, but it's a complex kind of directness. And there were some pieces that I particularly liked, for example, the violin concerto. I had never heard that, and it has become one of my favorite of all violin concerto compositions after hearing that. It's just such a gorgeous piece. There's so much lyricism in it.
He Yet, in an indication of how badly Minotti fell out of fashion, Oberthorn often had to do some serious hunting to find the original recordings for digitization. The console had been done by American Decca, which was more of a Broadway and pop label, and had been bought by so many companies who knew what was in its catalog. Even major Columbia label recordings by the Robin Hood Dell Orchestra, the summer version of the Philadelphia Orchestra, had been forgotten for decades.
You can see this in the recordings. There are a large number of recordings of his works that you see appear in the late 40s through the mid-50s, and then it drops off almost completely after that. And his coverage on record is very spotty after that. So you can gauge how he fell out of favor with the public and the critics based on how you see the recordings dwindle.
Minotti wasn't the only famous Curtis-educated composer falling from grace. Both Samuel Barber and Leonard Bernstein felt increasingly marginalized amid the experimental avant-garde. Composers who kept their feet on the ground justified themselves by taking on important subject matter. Bernstein duked it out with God in his Kaddish Symphony. Barber went deep into the brutal world of ancient myth with modern takes on Medea and Cleopatra. Minotti embraced socially relevant subjects that seemed not to speak so deeply to him. Oberthorn attended the premiere of The Hero in Philadelphia and remembers not the music, but its references to Watergate.
It was done at the time of the bicentennial, and it was a comic opera, and there were some comic references to the Rosemary Woods 18 missing minutes of tape in the Watergate tapes. It seemed to be, again, accessible. It was something that was easily understandable in English without the super titles in the Academy.
In his final period, Minotti took on historic subjects that were basically new operas attempting to masquerade as old ones. No bad thing had they turned out well, but they did not, and reflected badly on his earlier works. Were they really that good? Opera New Jersey's Richard Russell was among the doubters.
When I was growing up, he was still producing operas, so I remember Goya, some of those other things that really were kind of dire. And it does make you think, okay, were we right?
What happened to Giancarlo Minotti? Barber was no longer so much in his life as time went on, and lacking a close proximity to the more musically cosmopolitan Barber may have been a bigger loss for Minotti than one might think, as he suggested in this 1980 interview published by West Hill Radio Archive.
In a certain way, Sam was also one of my composition teachers. Because in Italy, musical education was still rather primitive in a certain way. And concerts in Italy where the repertory was very limited. And again, Lieder was, concerts of Lieder in Italy were very, very rare. So again, he introduced me to a whole world of Schubert and Schumann that I did not know. And for me it was very important because in getting acquainted with Schubert's Lieder, it changed my style. For me it was a wonderful experience.
A huge creative departure for Minotti was his most Barber-esque opera, Maria Golovin, from 1958, written about the same time as Barber's Vanessa. Typically, Minotti operas were full of external events. This one has a more Chekhovian approach, whose action is all internal. It failed on Broadway. Maybe it wouldn't have in the opera house. Later, in the occasional instances when Minotti returned to this Barber-influenced Schubertian mode, the feeling is also quite different. So often, even in Minotti's best operas, his music is extremely personable, but not very personal. You feel him pulling the heartstrings like a master puppeteer, but you rarely hear him reveal himself. As time went on, and the operas got worse, Minotti's music seemed to grow so impersonal that it could have been written by anybody. What was behind this? Minotti was fond of saying, "My life is an open book, but I don't leave it lying around." What that meant is that he maintained a haze of truth, the kind that had many possible interpretations. And then, from beyond the grave, Minotti surprised me. Some friends returned from hearing the opera star Christine Brewer at Chautauqua, New York, with news of a recital that included the Menotti cycle, Songs of Absence, written in 1967 for Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. I chased down a recording, and Menotti opened his heart before my very ears. There he was, writing about the impossibility of love using nautical metaphors, such as, "My ship is rigged, but cannot sail." And that poses a bigger but thoroughly unanswerable question. Would there have been more music like this, and maybe not so many barren years, had he lived in an era when his life could be an open book, period?
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The pioneering 20th century sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Escherich lived and worked in Philadelphia and the surrounding countryside, where his one-time studio and home is now a museum. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the life and influence of this artist who practiced a variety of artistic disciplines before achieving fame for his curvilinear freeform sculpture.
25 miles west of Philadelphia, off the highways, beyond parkland and pastures, a road curves and climbs up a forested hill. At the top, nestled in the woods, is where artist Wharton Escherich lived and created the innovative forms, carved mostly from wood, that prompted his peers to call him the Dean of American Craftsmen and paved the way for the American studio furniture movement. Paul Eisenhower, curator of what is now the Wharton Escherich Museum, says prior to Escherich,
you had the traditional furniture maker copying traditional styles and doing beautiful reproduction kind of work. And then you had the industrial designers using industrial techniques and new methods and new materials, aluminum and plastics.
Escherich says Eisenhower took the best of those two worlds, bringing in his own background in arts and crafts and his love of the countryside.
And produced pieces like none that had ever been done before, and was using a traditional medium of wood to produce fine art, and not just fine art, but functional fine art.
The museum building itself, a stone farmhouse with wood and stucco additions, reflects Escherich's artistic evolution from the arts and crafts style through German Expressionism and beyond. Inside, nearly everything is crafted, from small light fixtures and coat hooks to large freestanding sculptures, like that of a couple entwined and a horse in motion, to his famous trapezoidal spiral staircase that appeared in the 1940 World's Fair. There are few, if any, right angles. Shapes appear to buckle and bend. Edges go this way and that, conjuring a whimsical world unto itself.
If you had to describe him, organic is the word. Flowing form that looks like it comes from nature. Nature rarely has right angles, and it rarely has straight or parallel lines.
So who was this sculptor of international acclaim who lived in the woods with a copy of Thoreau's Walden by his bedside? Bill Whitaker is curator of architectural archives at the University of Pennsylvania.
Our understanding of Escherich in some ways has been limited by seeing Escherich as a furniture maker. And he himself didn't see himself as a furniture maker. He saw himself as an artist.
Whitaker says Escherich's roots, the early friends, places, and passions he embraced, supported and nourished his growth into a pivotal figure in American modernism.
You have to push down into this earlier period of his life. You have to show this wide variety of art and work that he was exploring at the period to really see the brilliance of the later work.
Escherich was born in 1887 in Philadelphia, married a former classmate from high school, and moved out to the countryside. He set out to be an impressionist painter, but had a difficult time selling his work. Then came a trip to Fairhope, Alabama, where his wife wanted to study progressive education. It was here, says Lynn Farrington, curator of printed books at Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, that Escherich began carving frames for his paintings.
People are more interested in the frames he's carved than the pictures he's painted. He then starts making wood engravings and woodblock prints and discovers that he has an interest, he enjoys it. Then gradually moves into other things as well. He moves into furniture, he's starting to play with angles, he's starting to explore different ways of expressing himself.
While Escherich lived in the Philadelphia area, his work was informed by other travels as well, including trips to New York City and the Adirondacks, where he participated in dance camps. He became friends with prominent writers Sherwood Anderson and Theodore Dreiser, as well as Harold Mason, owner of Center City Philadelphia's gathering place for artists, the Centaur Bookstore, which published his woodcut illustrations in books by Walt Whitman and D.H. Lawrence, among others. A lover of dance and music, his first sculptures included dancers and a firebird. He attended the Philadelphia Orchestra, getting to know concertmaster Alexander Hillsburg and later board member Curtis Bach. He was also very involved in Hedgerow Theater. Hedgerow's artistic director Penelope Reed says founder Jasper Dieter and Escherich became fast friends.
And he did artwork, graphics, sets. We have a beautiful Escherich table that he built for the actors to eat at. And we have the hammer-handled chairs, axe-handled chairs. And he gave them as payment for acting classes for his daughter.
Escherich made hundreds and hundreds of sketches of performances at Hedgerow. But he actually drew everywhere, Eisenhower says, using his pencil the way most people would a camera.
So you get this kind of travelogue, looking through his sketches of the places he's going and his friends and what they're doing and seeing.
Escherich played artistically with what we'd call today found objects, making chairs like the ones from Hedgerow from hammer handles. He also turned leftover circular wood shapes from a wheel maker into wagon wheel chairs.
And each chair was different, and each chair evolved over time into a more complex form that then results in a suite of furniture that he does for the World's Fair in 1940.
He also did high-profile commissions. One of his principal patrons was Philadelphia Orchestra board member Curtis Bach, for whom he designed a house, a fireplace mantle from which is in the Philadelphia Museum of Art's permanent collection. With the completion of the Bach House in the late 30s, Wharton Escherich was developing his own curvaceous style and finally making a national and international name for himself as an artist for whom modernism didn't have to mean metallic or industrial materials, and a furniture maker who crafted commonplace objects in uncommon ways.
Like Cézanne, he taught people to see differently. Sculptors started thinking about furniture and other functional items differently, and people who made functional items started thinking about them differently as well. So it was really bridging that gap between art and craft.
Like his art, Wharton Escherich himself defies easy definition, embracing music and dance, theater and books. Escherich liked the shore and the mountains, Alabama and New York City, always coming home to a wooded hillside in rural Pennsylvania. An artist who loved to make art and then use it.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Wharton Escherich Museum in Paoli, Pennsylvania, conducts guided tours by reservation year-round. Philadelphia area native Donald Nally has had a varied and storied career. He's been Artistic Director of the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia and at various times Chorus Master of the Opera Company of Philadelphia, the Spoleto Festival in Italy, Welsh National Opera in the UK, and Lyric Opera of Chicago, from where he just stepped down to more fully dedicate himself to what he acknowledges as his greatest passion, The Crossing, the Philadelphia-based chamber ensemble co-founded by Nally in 2005 and dedicated to performing new and contemporary choral music. Despite this dedication to the new, Nally says The Crossing's mission is not to be an apostle for the avant-garde, but simply to present great musical performances.
In choral music today, if you are really doing music that's written in the last 15 years, you're going to find very little that would fall into the category of avant-garde because we're really in a postmodern era for that music anyway. And so much of tonality has returned to composers' ears in terms of writing for chorus. And I could talk about that for ages because I think they finally figured out that voices just actually don't pick pitches out of the air, you know, and especially truly beautiful voices, you know, very seldom do those two talents come together. So I would say that the point is that we just love singing what I would call artistic reactions or creative people's reactions to our world. So we are interested in what voices today, how they describe our world. I mean, the whole I've said this before.
Well, the whole purpose of art is...
The whole purpose of art. You know, you buy a ticket and you go and you sit down in the concert and, you know, why do you do that? Well, because what you're about to hear, what you hear is in some way either enriching or enhancing to you, but it also hopefully will allow you to recognize in yourself things that you know or forgot or memories And emotions that you may not in your everyday life, you know, driving around the city and working, et cetera, allow yourself the space to do. And all of that is a part of what art is, you know. But what the composers and the other artists in the world are doing is sort of describing our world with a pen and a paper, and in particular in choral music, in sound. And that is really fascinating to me, and it's really fascinating to the singers who sing with the crossing. I mean, you have to be invested in it. You're not just, you know, this is not gigging, and you're not going to walk in there and go like, oh, yeah, today we're doing, you know, and that'll be fun, and then we'll walk away. No, it's an investment. You really need to love what we're doing. And so in that way, I would say that, no, we're not really evangelizing for the avant-garde or even for the modern or the contemporary. We're just trying to put on a really good show. Like,
you're not trying to educate anybody. You're not trying to inform anybody as to the state of the art. You're looking for an emotional reaction, and you are finally entertaining people.
Yeah, I think that describes it very well. I mean, we're not really in education. I have a lot of people that come to concerts and say, I discovered things I didn't know, you know, or I always learn something when I'm here. But, you know, I think largely they're not talking about the educational value of it. They're talking about sounds that meant something to them that they would not have otherwise, A, heard, or B, recognized as having any relevance to them.
The crossing came because a bunch of people who liked working with each other and were friends decided they were going to put on a concert so they could hang out together in the way that they hang out together. And it's now developed into something actually rather unlikely, that you have a chamber ensemble that does new and contemporary work and is gaining in popularity. I mean, a lot of this is against the odds. Since you had no ambitions for it when you began, how far can this go?
I don't know how far it can go, because we haven't asked that question, and I think it's wise not to.
Well, bigger venues? More recordings?
I think what's happened in this really incredibly joyful way, which I guess could be easily demonstrated by the fact that I just left a really great job in Chicago to come back and be closer to this organization and to invest more in it. That's a good demonstration of the fact that every day is kind of a surprise at the crossing. Look, we know we have an extraordinary collection of artists who are working together, and that is what part of what makes the work so incredibly joyful. So that level of communication between the artists speaks to a certain audience. And what we didn't know was the size of that audience. And I don't just mean the numbers of people who come to a concert in Philadelphia, but also the interest in it from beyond there.
And from beyond the regular classical music world as well, which is worth mentioning. That people are going to your concerts who just don't go to anything else.
Yes. So somewhat more diverse in terms of what their other concert-going or art-attending experiences are. So the funny thing is that as we look at our schedule for the coming year, for example, we are just working constantly because of the number of people who have reached out to us. And I guess that gets back to my surprise in a way and joy at seeing that there is a place for a group like this in so many circumstances. So while someone might go, well, this group can handle the difficulty of this piece, we need them, another person might say, I love that sound and I want that sound, and, you know, will you come and do this? And so this is where these collaborations with ICE and this recording that we're going to be doing coming up next year with Network for New Music, and, you know, it's just working with really high caliber musicians that have heard us and are interested in that. So, you know, we're looking now at 2012, 2013, and going, we don't know how to schedule around all the other organizations in Philadelphia because we want to make sure that the singers can make as much of a living as possible from singing, which means that we do need to share them with so many other organizations and churches and synagogues.
But is the ideal then that you would turn around to this core group of 22, 24 singers and say, okay, guys, give up the day jobs?
Yeah, of course you do. Yes, there's no reason not to. Why not take, you know, if someone writes that big check, you say, this is the dream come true. This is it. But I guess what I want to say, going all the way back to the beginning of this question, how far can you go? This is the dream come true right now.
Donald Nally, co-founder and conductor of The Crossing. WRTI will begin broadcasting the Philadelphia-based Chamber Choir's concerts later this year. An exhibition now at the Philadelphia Museum of Art showcases 10 Philadelphia artists Curator Innes Shoemaker says her goal was to reflect the remarkable strength and diversity of talent that exists in the city's cultural community. Here and Now, prints, drawings and photographs by 10 Philadelphia artists features a diversity of media, forms and scales, and all within the boundaries of Innes Shoemaker's curatorial scope.
I'm head of the Department of Prints, Drawings and Photographs, and so I decided I wanted to unite all of those things because artists are working across mediums now. And for example, Isaac Lynn paints on photographs that he didn't necessarily take himself, but there are also regular straight photographers like Vincent Feldman. My greatest restriction was the size of the gallery, so I decided I could fit 10 artists and represent each of them.
Though the artists are representative of Philadelphia, very little of the city is represented in the work, right?
That's true. Only in the group of photographs by Hannah Price, who has been taking photographs of Philadelphia, because this is a city that she has recently moved into, and she's documenting this new phase of her life. Some of them just work in completely different ways, in abstract modes, and many of them deal with social and political problems. Some of them deal with commercialism. One of them deals with obsessive drawing techniques. It's a wide range, and that was another thing I wanted to do, was I really wanted to represent the broad, diverse range of talent in the city. Now, there's much more out there, obviously, than 10 artists, but I think you'll see that there's a lot of the work that doesn't just necessarily complement the work of what's next to it, but that was part of my point.
Despite the limitations of the size of the gallery, you do, though, have some large works.
Well, there are two pieces. One is a multi-part print, a 65-part etching by Daniel Heyman that you'll see when you enter the gallery. I can't remember the exact dimensions, but I would say it is probably 15 feet wide. It's on a 20-foot wall. And across from the entrance to the Stieglitz Gallery is a painted wall by Isaac Lynn, which I've installed four of his painted photographs on. And Isaac came and spent 7 days painting this incredible mural that is brilliant in color and is swarming with all kinds of calligraphic notations that look like combinations of Arabic calligraphy, Chinese lettering, and any number of other things. When I visited Isaac at his studio, I was so taken by the proliferation of these incredible designs that also occur on the photographs that he paints, that I asked him if he would be interested in painting a wall that we would install his photographs on. And he liked the idea, and so he came in and did it.
And what happens to that wall after this exhibition?
It'll be destroyed. Unfortunately, that's one of those things. And sadly, because it's very beautiful.
You mentioned earlier on about the fact that many of these artists are working in many different media, sometimes at the same time, i.e. Mm-hmm. painting and photographs. That seems to be very much the case now, that we're moving away from the traditional model of an artist saying, I am a painter, or I am a sculptor, or I am a photographer.
That's true. And in fact, almost all of these artists work in installation, in photography, painting, drawing, printmaking. There are very few of them who actually concentrate in only one medium.
So do we need to change your title then from curator of prints, drawings and photographs to curator of everything else?
Well, I think that would make every curator in the museum who works with contemporary art curator of everything else. So that's right. That's right.
Philadelphia Museum of Art, curator of prints, photographs and drawings, Innes Shoemaker. Here and Now, prints, drawings and photographs by 10 Philadelphia artists, runs through December 4th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.